Not Ben Lundin, it's a different name. All right, yeah, today I thought I'd talk a little bit, because this is such a shining example of a place that, that thinks about the foundations and fundamental physics. I thought I'd talk about this stuff, which I have been working on with my graduate student, Rishi Khatri, who I have to give much of the credit to for this work. He's, I think I'm taking lots of pictures with my mobile phone, I guess, of my, of the inside of my we'll have to give much of the credit to for this work, though not for this presentation, which I put together on a very short schedule coming in. So he's the sort of graduate student that makes it possible to actually explore a new area, with, which is normally something you can only do with postdocs. So as I said, much of the credit for this goes to him. So 21 centimeter radiation, what does that mean? Well, I guess the one of the, if you want to take my work and sort of put a an overarching theme over it, it will be trying to link fundamental physics to astronomical observations, astrophysical observations. And so here's a sketch of that. Of course, here's the timeline in reverse. Okay, I mean, looking look back time going this way. Here's now, and stars and galaxies. As we look further, we see the CMB, which reaches us from when the universe was only 400,000 years old, and then Big Bang nuclear synthesis happened about three minutes or a couple of minutes after the Big Bang, and then at much earlier times, the universe was hot enough to that laws of physics were acting that we want to learn about. And the question is, how can we learn about what happened in the Big Bang if you think of the universe as this big, massive particle accelerator experiment that we try to study now using astronomical observations? Is there a pointer or the famous hockey stick? Oh, there it is. Okay. What we can probe with astronomical observations by looking at basically fossil nuclei from Big Bang nuclear synthesis are these redshifts of 10 to the 9. We can probe the cosmic microwave background in a great deal, with a great deal of accuracy, which takes us back to when the universe was 1,000 times smaller than it is today. And this allows us to probe K modes of order 0.1 inverse megaparsec, so roughly speaking, tens of megaparsecs. Large scale structure probes the universe later and on similar scales, somewhat shorter scales. The Lyman Alpha Forest also probes the universe on similar scales, however, shorter scales, but slightly earlier times. And the reason why this is a powerful technique is because we want to probe the universe in the regime where these perturbations are still still linear. So as far away from nonlinear gravitational collapse as possible, because that's when they still contain information about what happened in the early universe to set them up. And what I will focus on are these dark ages in the middle that I didn't mention. And they are really the final astronomical frontier. And how do we actually probe these dark ages? Well, during the dark ages, all you have is a very boring universe, really, which is filled with hydrogen, mostly hydrogen. A quarter of the mass is in helium. And it's dark. There are no sources of light. There are no stars. The only light there is the cosmic microwave background that stream the photons that stream through the universe. And if we focus on the hydrogen, there's of course the hydrogen atoms. Neutral hydrogen atoms have this 21 centimeter line transition, which is at a wavelength of 21 centimeter, obviously, and at a frequency of about 1.4 gigahertz. And so this transition, it turns out, is actually observable. And if we were able to observe this transition, we could probe the universe at a different range of times and length scales. So between this, the redshift of 1,100, when the cosmic microwave background is emitted, down to redshifts of around 6 or so, there's a desert right now because we just can't see the stars and the galaxies from beyond redshift of 6. And actually, at some point, there are no stars and no galaxies. But if we were able to probe this intermediate regime here, we'd be able to probe redshifts between 200 and 6 or so, which is 10, roughly 10, and much, much smaller scales. The reason why we can probe such small scales is, first of all, these small scales at those early times have not yet gone nonlinear. And secondly, you're looking at structure that's imprinted on the neutral gas rather than being in photons, where photons can, of course, stream and wipe out structure on small scales. So if you're looking at this gas, you're looking at perturbations on short scales, thinking of basically kiloparsec scales here, which is very short by cosmological standards. This is a huge amount of information that can potentially reside there. Okay. So why can we see this gas? Does it emit, or how do we do this? Well, if we think about the thermal history of the universe, the cosmic microwave background just sits there and cools over time, whereas the gas at first is still actually coupled to the cosmic microwave background. So some people say baryon decoupling happens much later, after redshift of 1,100, when the photons decouple. But the hydrogen is actually still it still interacts at some level with the photons. And so the CMB keeps the gas hot for a while. But then the gas starts cooling adiabatically. And what I've drawn here is the spin temperature. And this is the basically given by the ratio of the population of the upper and lower state of the hyperfine transition that I just showed. This is defined like this. And the spin temperature is actually coupled to the gas temperature for a while. But eventually, the gas becomes so rarefied. And this happens through collisions. So two hydrogen atoms collide with each other. And some of the energy in the collision gets transferred into spin flips. But then after a while, that doesn't happen anymore. And so then this actually decouples from the gas. And at some point later on, at lower redshift, the absorption and emission from CMB photons actually starts coupling these spins to the CMB. So basically, there are more collisions, which keep the spin temperature close to the gas temperature at first. Then when the collisions stop, then interactions with CMB photons make the spin temperature go and approach the CMB temperature. But there's this period here between a redshift of around 20 or so and roughly 150, where the spin temperature, or actually 200, where the spin temperature is significantly below the CMB temperature. And what that means is that CMB photons that happen to be at the right frequency, at the right wavelength of 21 centimeters, get absorbed. Okay, just have, and they bump up the electron to the higher level. And this absorption happens along the line of sight. So if you look in a particular direction, the CMB photons from reaching us from that direction will be absorbed and then re-radiated in a random fashion. But along our line of sight, these photons will be taken out. And so you see an absorption feature. If there's gas there, you see absorption. And so this is 21 centimeter absorption from hydrogen, which is, which is at these very high redshifts that are completely inaccessible to observation in terms of looking at luminous things, because there are no luminous things there. You're using the CMB as a backlight, and this line, the 21 centimeter line, as a way of tracing the hydrogen along the line of sight. So the spin temperature, this difference between the spin temperature and the CMB temperature, can be converted into a brightness temperature, which is basically the temperature decrement you see along the line of sight. There's this coupling constant, and the coupling constant is proportional to the density of hydrogen. And so You can use this then to trace the hydrogen density along your line of sight. And this works along every line of sight, okay, because there's gas everywhere and the CMB comes from everywhere. So you can build up, you can use this then to build up a three-dimensional picture of the gas distribution, neutral gas distribution, between redshift of roughly 20 to all the way out to 200, and study this gas distribution. This is a new observational window. If this window could be opened, we would have access to this 3D information. Even actually, after I'm saying after, I'm sort of cutting this off at 30, because after redshift of 30, we start expecting formation of stars on very small scales to start affecting this. Stars will produce ionizing radiation, and they will start ionizing this neutral gas. And of course, then at that point, you don't see this 21 centimeter absorption feature anymore, and you basically see empty regions, because this only traces the neutral gas. And so the heating from stars also, actually what happens is before that, before you ionize, the heating from starlight will actually make this absorption into an emission feature. So the spin temperature will start rising above the CMB temperature in some regions, and you should be able to see emission from the neutral gas. And then after some more time, the ionized regions will start taking over the filling the volume of the universe, at which point this 21 centimeter signal goes away. And that happens around redshift of 10 or so. Yes?
Most of the variables to observe the 21 centimeters are a very small part of the Q, of the low energy Q of the CMB.
That's right. Yeah.
So, and still they're so efficient.
Right, exactly right. So, As you know, right, the CMB photons have a continuum spectrum, so they have a Planck distribution, and so there will be photons in the long wavelength tail of that distribution, and because there's so many CMB photons, this is a signal that is observable. Actually, the average absorption signal is a whopping big signal that you could see with any old radio telescope. Turns out, you know, radio telescopes are really sensitive instruments. So it's not a problem in terms of just pure sensitivity at all to see this absorption signal. What is a problem is that we sit near emission features in the range of frequencies. See, this is the absorption at every given redshift happens at 1.4 gigahertz, the frequency, a 21 centimeter wavelength, which is the wavelength of this feature. But of course, over time, this frequency redshifts. And so the range of frequencies that we're talking about today is between 50 and 200 megahertz. That's low frequency radio. Actually, 50 to 200 megahertz is between in this range. Actually, if you want to go out to redshift of 200, you're talking about 7 megahertz. 7 megahertz is a very, very tough frequency to observe in, because synchrotron radiation from the galaxy is extremely bright there. We're talking tens of thousands of Kelvin. If you turn this into it's non-thermal radiation, but if you turn it into a temperature, equivalent temperature, it will be tens of thousands of Kelvin, whereas this absorption signal, I'll show you in a minute, is tens of millikelvin. Okay, so the difficulty is just to get rid of this very, very large foreground component that comes from our own galaxy. It's not the difficulty of being sensitive enough to measure this kind of temperature decrement. That's no problem at all. But being able to subtract off this huge foreground component, that's the tough part. Basically, you're sitting in a system, the galaxy, which is you know, tens of thousands of Kelvin hot. And within such a system, you're trying to look out and see things that vary only on the order of tens of millikelvin. So that's the observational challenge. But in terms of information in this window, it's extremely rich. And the reason why this is so interesting, why this has caused so much attention, is because what I just outlined, photons diffuse because they're relativistic, and so it's hard to keep them together and keep them keep small-scale perturbations in these photons. Whereas the gas is there, and the perturbations are just imprinted in the gas density, And if you're looking at the CMB power spectrum, you see there's power here at the very large scales. And CMB is excellent for probing the largest scales in the universe, because the CMB is an image of the potential perturbations. The potential perturbations are scale-free in this scale-free. So, but on small scales, there's this exponential suppression here due to photon, the soak damping effect. And just basically photons sort of rattling free off of the baryons when photons and baryons decouple. Whereas in the if I take a particular slice, of course now I can take slices not just as, at a single redshift of 1,100, but I can take slices at redshifts of 30, 50, 100, 200, and everywhere in between to have a 3D picture. The information in this 21 centimeter radiation goes out all the way to several millions in L. So in principle, you can access a huge amount of information. And that, if you just count the number of modes, it makes this argument very easy to grasp. The number of modes in the cosmic microwave background is roughly 10 to the 7, or maybe 10 to the 8, or 10 to the 9. Whereas here, the number of modes is more like 10 to the 16. So it's just a huge ratio of available modes. Okay, so so we want to use this information to place constraints on fundamental physics. And the two cases that we've looked at, these are part of a larger program that we want to pursue, because of going through a bunch of different observational effects and many other things you can do with this that haven't yet been done. But the two that we've done first are variations in the fine structure constant, temporal variations in the fine structure constant, and constraints on cosmic strings. And of course, before I say this, I should again emphasize that this is not measured, been measured yet, and it won't be measured for some time. But there's a possibility of, there are ways of overcoming some of these difficulties that I've just outlined. I am concerned with this, maybe more so than you are. But let me outline why I think this is at least possible in principle, and there have been studies to support this. And the idea is basically the following: if you want to observe this, and you have a here's the foreground spectrum. This is your synchrotron spectrum, and this is frequency, and this is sort of intensity as a function of frequency, and here's the the synchrotron foreground from the galaxy, which is enormous. And I told you, there's basically this tiny little decrement here that you're trying to see. But that's very, very difficult to do on average. But if you actually look as a function of frequency, because the gas distribution isn't completely homogeneous, but because there are small variations in the gas density, in fact, there's a very small, I'm going to exaggerate this a lot, but there are these small scale variations here which trace the gas density, which are on top of this extremely much smaller in amplitude than this foreground, but they are also completely separated in scale. These are short scale variations in frequency along any given line of sight. So you're looking along a particular line of sight, you see this whopping huge great big foreground signal, but then as you tune your frequency, you see that this big signal moves around, as a very fast function of frequency. And that fast function of frequency, that the fact that this the foreground spectra are extremely smooth, and there are good physical reasons for that to be the case, and that the short scale perturbations in the primordial hydrogen give you very fast variations, you can then apply filters to separate out these two long scale and the short scale variations. And while it's difficult to actually observe the average absorption, it should be possible to go and observe the inhomogeneities along the line of sight of these perturbations. Okay, so the idea is to filter this using doing a high pass filter, which then gets rid of this big foreground and looks at the small scale. And that's the challenge, because you then need you then need enough sensitivity to get the errors down to see the small scale variation, and to be able to apply these filters without drowning the signal in noise. Yeah. To the extent that we know, it looks smooth, but it's very hard to see how you would get these very short scale. We were talking about this is in the range of tens of megahertz, and when you look at spectra from other galaxies, for example, or the spectrum in our galaxy, it just changes basically like a power law, and the power law might have a little bit of a bend in it, but it's not. It's just, it doesn't have spectral features. Spatially, looking in different directions, you might have different amounts of foreground. Yeah, that's right. For example, if you're looking at, there's the North Galactic Spur and those kinds of things, so regions with more synchrotron radiation. But this argument works in all directions. It might just give you more noise in regions with more synchrotron radiation than other regions. Okay. So yes, this is a challenge, but I think it's not, it's still, given the extreme amount of information that is potentially observable in the signal, I think it's worth thinking about whether we should be building the kinds of instruments that will be able to see this. And the reason for building these instruments is to say, well, if you do that, you learn about fundamental physics, and this is the rationale for what I will talk about now. So why do we want to look for variations in the fine structure constant? Well, they are a possible signature of physics beyond the standard model. You can use them to test the equivalence principle and hence look for deviations from general relativity. So basically, if the laws of physics change as a function of position in a general way, this will be one signal of that. And also, if dark energy if the fundamental constants couple to a field that is responsible for the dark energy, and if there are perturbations in that field, then this could, and certainly temporal changes in that field would be revealed, and also in the change of the fundamental constants. So the idea is to, and obviously we know that in the standard model the constants are constant, so I think the first one is probably the strongest variation, but more generally, for example, in chameleon models, which Justin worked on, who was here, you would expect not just dark energy to vary with time, but also the constants to be affected. And in fact, I will talk about temporal changes of the fine structure constant, but I think spatial changes are another area that one could explore with this. So what are the current constraints on variations in alpha? In lab experiments, you get down to alpha dot over alpha roughly 10 to the minus 14 per year. But since we're talking, you have to compare that to the age of the universe, which is 10 to the 10 years. So it's really 1 part in 10 to the 4 over the history of the universe. The Oklo natural fission reactor gives constraints of delta alpha over alpha less than 10 to the minus 8 over a period of 2 billion years. So this is a weaker, this is, well, it's a slight, let's see, so 2 billion years is 10 to the 9, so this is actually a slightly stronger constraint if you think about the whole history of the universe. If you look at Big Bang nucleosynthesis and see how a different fine structure constant during the epoch of BBN would change nucleosynthesis, and compare that to the observed abundances of primordial nuclei, we can get constraints of the order of a few percent. And then Rocha et al. Gives a constraint also from the cosmic microwave background of roughly the order of delta alpha over alpha of a few percent. And the effect here is mostly from just the couplings that occur in the recombination physics. So how quickly does hydrogen recombine? That's basically what drives the dependence of cosmic microwave background on alpha. There's a tantalizing controversy in the literature on delta alpha over alpha in the quasar, seen in quasar spectra. there is evidence for delta alpha over alpha at the level of 10 to the minus 5, going back to redshift of 3.5. But there's also an opposing argument or opposing data that seem to contradict that. So I won't comment on the quality of that. I'm not an expert. I haven't studied the details of this measurement. But there's some observational hints. Certainly the kinds of accuracies you can get here are at the level of 10 to the minus 5 over roughly over the history of the universe. So I guess this is same information. So how does the 21 centimeter radiation respond to changes in the fine structure constant? It turns out as you can imagine, the spin temperature I was telling you before, it actually depends on the collisions between hydrogen atoms and the emission absorption of photons by hydrogen. And that's set by the Einstein coefficients and by the collision cross-sections between hydrogen atoms, and they all depend on the fine structure constant. We spend a lot of time calculating collision cross-sections between hydrogen atoms as a function of the fine structure constant, but it turns out to be a very simple problem. You just have to perturb the existing results, and it turns out to work very nicely at first-order and perturbation theory. That doesn't actually give you much of a signal. It's a relatively small contribution. Really, the big contribution comes from the interaction between hydrogen atoms and photons, which scales like alpha to the 13th power. So this is what caught our attention really and made that our first project in looking at 21 centimeter fundamental physics from 21 centimeter radiation. So here's what happens. So as a function of redshift, these are lines basically redrawn. This is the gas temperature, and this is the spin temperature as a function of redshift for different changes in alpha. So you can see when I change alpha upwards, I increase the interaction with the photons, and so I start thermalizing more quickly. If I change it downwards, the opposite thing happens. So you can get these kinds of variations in this average, in the spin temperature, which basically translates into an average absorption. If I look at the brightness temperature here, this is basically the difference between the spin temperature and the CMB temperature. You can see I can get relatively large fractional changes, roughly 10, 20% fractional changes for variations in alpha of roughly 1 or 2%. But again, remember, as I was just saying, this average signal, this average absorption signal, is very difficult to pick out because it's a signal that basically gives you just a slight decrement compared to this foreground signal over a large range in redshift. So what we then did is we calculated the change in the power spectrum and the predicted amplitude of these perturbations. And the amplitude of these perturbations are actually proportional to basically the average decrement. And so that gives you, at different redshifts, gives you different amounts of change in the square root of the power spectrum. So this is delta square root of CL over square root of CL. And you get a time-dependent change in the amplitude. So it's a template that you can use to fit to. Basically, the main effect, up to some slight changes here on small scales, but the main effect is a change in the amplitude that depends on redshift in the power spectrum compared to what you would expect based on the standard thermal history. So you can look for that change in the amplitude, a redshift-dependent change in the amplitude, which is sort of a signal that you can pick out, and then use that to constrain alpha.
What's the model for alpha variation?
It's constant.
So it's constant and now changes recently.
What we're basically saying is that alpha during this period of time was a different value, and then changed at some point in between. Okay, just at some point in between. So if it's a slow continuous change, then this is the prevalent value of alpha during the epoch of of the dark during the dark ages. Now, there's an additional feature to this, of course, which is even if we, this gives you, I'll show you in a minute, this gives you a tremendous potential increase in sensitivity to changes in alpha. But even if it didn't, even if it were at the same level as the cosmic microwave dark one, it would still give you another time epoch over which you could change, test, measure alpha independently from the BBN or from the CMB or the quasars. That's kind of the three epochs that we can have access to the value of alpha.
All right.
Here, the variation is at the level of 2%, I think. Either 1% or 2%. But I will translate that to you, translate that into statements about sensitivity in a minute. So this is just looking at the sensitivity and the average absorption signal, and that would give you, with an instrument that will I think already online, would give you a constraint of 1%. So this is the case where we're saying, well, practice it's impossible, but sensitivity is not the issue. This would give you 1%. Within 4 years, you could reach 0.3% in delta alpha over alpha. But in terms of foregrounds, this is much harder. So this is the constraint. These are the constraints you would get from the perturbations, which you could separate from the foregrounds. Yeah. Oh, this is this is called the long wavelength array. This is an instrument. This is a long wavelength radio array that's being built in New Mexico. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So this will probe down to 10 megahertz. So we ran through all the numbers, looking at this average absorption, and this is just in terms of raw sensitivity, you could get down to things that are competitive with Planck. It's about a square kilometer. But they will start with building one station, and they will add stations over time. Here is a picture of the kinds of constraints you could get by looking at these small perturbations, which you could separate from the foreground. And you get 10% constraints with LOFAR, which is another instrument that is about that's being commissioned in Europe. If you made LOFAR bigger, you could get far below the current CMB and BBN constraints. If you had a 10-kilometer square array, between 10 and 100-kilometer squared array, so this would be a large array, you would get down to limits that are below the competitive with the current quasar constraints. And if you had an array that covered an area of 1,000 kilometers squared, you could get an order of magnitude of 2 below the current quasar constraints. And in terms of just information content, if you extrapolate this cosmic variance limit all the way out, and I think this is actually for 10% of the sky, so this is not really cosmic variance limit. We've considered only the cleanest 10% of the sky in this. You could get down to just an incredibly small constraints, and basically delta alpha over alpha 10 to the minus 10 over a period of 10 to the 10 years. So this would be a million times better than current laboratory constraints on delta alpha over alpha. Now, okay, so obviously these are technologically challenging. 10 kilometer square array, it's 100 times bigger than the square kilometer array. But on the other hand, because this is on very large scales, this is not something that is, this is not high tech, actually. It's talking about radio technology that was all done in the 60s. And you don't actually need low noise receivers for this, because it turns out the sky is much hotter than your receivers. Remember, the synchrotron radiation in the galaxy translates to a temperature of tens of thousands of Kelvin. So as long as your receivers in your instrument aren't tens of thousands of Kelvin, you're doing better than the galaxy. And so all you need is area. You need collecting area to average down the noise from the sky, the foreground from the galaxy. And it turns out that, of course, the sky actually is, on Earth, on the atmosphere, is not transparent to this very long wavelength radiation. And so in order to really push this out to very long wavelengths, you'd have to go out into space. And I'll talk a bit more about that later. So here's the, I already discussed the part about foregrounds. Okay. This is the, okay, I think I already said that. Okay, so let me now turn to superstring constraints, cosmic superstring constraints from 21 centimeter radiation. I think I can probably skip through most of the introductory material for this crowd. Why cosmic strings? Well, we'll talk about some of these things, briefly remind you what cosmic strings are, and how to calculate perturbations from cosmic strings. Cosmic strings are topological defects, which get produced by relics of phase transition in the early universe. And defects are places where the universe cannot relax to the new state because of topological frustration. Domain walls are one example, which are these occur when the Z2 symmetry is broken. They produce sheet-like separations between domains. And here's cosmic strings. So this is the Mexican hat potential, and the vacuum manifold is U1. So these happen when the U1 symmetry is broken in the phase transition. So cosmic strings have weird and wonderful properties. They have an angle deficit. They can act as lenses. They're various, these give ways to actually observe cosmic strings. A cuspy string can burst particles because you can have a little bit of annihilation of the string near the cusp. They couple to gravity and source scalar vector and tensor perturbations. If they move around, they can radiate gravitational waves, especially the near regions of large string curvature that produce. They move quickly and accelerate quickly. String dynamics can be calculated. They move such as to minimize the world sheet area they sweep out, just like the strings that you're familiar with, fundamental strings. There are you can calculate how they interact with the kind of perturbations that they would produce by assuming that they're so massive that they ignore all the perturbations in other matter, which is the stiff approximation. When strings come close to each other, so this is kind of the geometric way of doing string evolution, but when they come close to each other, you have to ask the field theory what happens. The details of the field theory matter in that case. If you have gauge strings, strings will intercommute when they intersect. It depends a little bit on coupling constants. There are cases where you can have strings sticking to each other, and other kinds of animals. If you have strings with opposing winding number finding each other, then they can annihilate. These are still frames from cosmic string simulation movies done by Allen and Shellard. Here's just a single string loop that, when it comes together, can join and then eventually radiate. And this is a whole string network from a cosmological simulation. Neil will find these very familiar. So one of the surprises about cosmic strings is that they haven't been observed yet, because they are ubiquitous in nature. They're generic. You can see them in phase transitions in condensed matter systems. You see them in pneumatic liquid crystals, liquid helium. And here are pictures of real strings. But there's absolutely no evidence whatsoever for them being in our universe. The current constraints limit the contribution of cosmic string produced perturbations to the cosmological perturbations to about 10% level. Compared to perturbations produced in an early phase that evolved passively under without being actively sourced by a network of strings. So how do they actually produce density perturbations? Basically, as they move through material, they kick matter behind them gravitationally when they move by. This produces a wake, and the overdensity in the wake just behind the string starts out at 2. So in principle, these kinds of wakes actually produce large overdensities, especially in the early universe, where you wouldn't see those kinds of overdensities as a consequence of just regular gravitational evolution. So here's this is my since Niaz mentioned my thesis. This is some work from a very long time ago, where I looked at hydrogen simulations and looking at the gas that compacts behind the cosmic string and forms of a cosmic string wake. And studying the differences in the dark matter and gas distributions behind the cosmic string wake. So I've sort of recently returned then to cosmic strings because I realized that if we were able to see 21 centimeter, the perturbations in the 21 centimeter radiation, we should get a very, very tight constraint on the contribution to the perturbations from cosmic strings that are seeded by cosmic strings. So this is an abbreviated form of the perturbation equations for cosmic strings. Basically, they look exactly the same for active sources as for the case that you're used to, where this is some initial seed. The only difference is this source term here, which is the energy momentum, the stress energy tensor due to the string network, or whatever else you have that's stirring the universe to produce perturbations. And of course, Neil provided the seminal contribution for actually calculating the contribution of cosmic strings and other topological defects to the cosmic microwave background spectrum. I'm not going to use Neil's method, though. I'm going to use another method, which I'll go into in just a minute. Okay, so the observational status, like I said, strings actually overproduce cosmic microwave background anisotropies for a given amount of large-scale structure. So what I'm showing here is a measured power spectrum of large-scale structure perturbations. This is perturbations in the galaxy distribution as a function of k, so the power spectrum. And here are predictions from a couple of different cosmic string models with some parameters that are tuned. And you can see that there's a large deficit. And these are actually fitted to match in terms of amplitude for the cosmic microwave background anisotropies. WMAP limits the, in terms of the shape of the spectrum, cosmic strings contribute to the CMB anisotropies. It's a very broad peak in the power spectrum. Let me just draw it quickly. So if this is L squared CL as a function of L, this is what you get from inflation, roughly speaking. And this is basically what the measurements look like. And if you add a contribution from cosmic strings, so cosmic strings basically roughly look like this. And so you can, this contribution, you can then compensate for this additional contribution by tweaking in the parameters in the other model. And but the most you can really contribute are roughly 10%. So this means that roughly at most 10% of the CMB are due to cosmic strings. And the most recent constraints, I think, are this paper here by Bevis et al. A few years ago, there was a resurgence of interest in cosmic strings. Basically, this realization, and Neil's calculation, and Andy's calculation, and the Albrecht's calculation, killed cosmic strings for about 5 years. and then they came back in a couple of papers by Poshinsky, where the claim was that in superstring-inspired inflation models, you can grow fundamental strings at the end of inflation to cosmic sizes. And this is reference to that. Actually, you can also have other stringy objects. You can have two-dimensional objects that just get stretched and look string-like. These objects can have very similar macroscopic dynamics as cosmic strings. So the same methods can be used to and have been revived to study these kinds of theories. There's an additional important parameter, though, which is the probability for intersection. So because these strings can live in, you know, fundamentally live in higher dimensions, they can miss each other. So they can come towards each other and actually miss each other and pass through each other. Whereas in the gauge strings, you always have this intersection, this kind of intercommutation with probability one, the global strings as well. So this intercommutation probability can change the properties of the string network at some level. However, you know, in the studies that I've seen so far, the intuition you might have about this are confirmed, which is that for a small amount of intersection, the string network for a small amount of intercommutation, the string network becomes denser. And the reason is that strings tend to wiggle around at first when there's still a lot of structure on them, or actually when there's structure on the string, they wiggle around, and they will self-intersect and chop off loops when they intercommute at the when they intercommute, they just chop off loops. These loops wiggle around and radiate away energy by gravitational radiation. And so this is basically a loss mechanism for the network, so the network density can scale as the universe expands and not overtake the density of matter in the universe. If you don't always intercommute, then you're less efficient in terms of destroying string that way, and so you get a denser network. It will still scale, but it will just be denser. These strings will basically, they conserve the density, the line density, or the tension in the strings is conserved. So by constraining the tension of cosmic superstring, you would constrain the fundamental parameter in string theory, the string scale. And the sort of theoretical estimates based on supersymmetry might be that the string scale is somewhere like 1,000 times less than the Planck scale. Or plug in your favorite value from your model. Okay, but generically, you expect this to be at the level of 10 to the 16 GeV or so. So why do we use 21 centimeter radiation to look for this? Again, if you look at the power spectrum here of the cosmic string contribution to the density perturbations, you see that while they are deficient in amplitude, they also decay less quickly than these perturbations that are laid down, that are from a model that are laid down in the early universe and just evolve passively. So you could imagine that if you were able to probe this to much higher k, to much smaller scales, you might be able to get some interesting constraints. So if you just look at the power and compare the power, we'll get some constraints. That's what I'm going to show you. A calculation we have not yet done is to look at this immediate nonlinearity of the string weights, the fact that compressing the gas behind the string, which can lead to interesting effects. In fact, people living around here might have heard about lake effect snow. My idea for calling this effect is wake effect glow. So, which is what would happen if you could imagine that the material gets compressed behind the string and actually glow for just a little bit until it cools down. And if you're able to, that would basically give you a snapshot of the string network. If the heating of the gas behind the string raises the gas temperature and the spin temperature above the CMB temperature, and this would happen at very early times. If you have a chance of happening at very early times, you could actually get a snapshot of the string network as 21 centimeter emission as opposed to absorption. That's an ongoing calculation. At those times, it's very linear. That's exactly why this is. I see. So, the reason. So, there are a couple of things going on. In the gas at redshift of 100, there's going to be a Jean scale, and there's going to be pressure support for the gas on below some scale. And if you look at the spectra that we compute, there's actually a visible cutoff at that scale. So that's one thing. So there's actually pressure support. In some regions of the universe, you will start forming dense clumps, which will start making stars. But 100 solar masses, which is the scale for the first stars, it's still far below those kinds of scales. We are interested in scales that are larger than that. But it's true. I mean, if you are talking about emission from single string wakes, that will be a very localized effect. So you know what you will probably, but the string itself can be very long. I mean, there are strings that, that reach all the way across the horizon. So what you would try to look for is sort of, you know, long features of a mission. And the string itself, actually, we're doing the calculation not with straight strings, but we're doing sort of a renormalization of the structure on the string into a Hamiltonian pretend, basically a sort of an effective mass per unit length of the string, which, and so, you know, this whole sort of wiggly structure of the string would produce a glow. So it's actually, you know, we don't rely on being able to resolve the thickness of the string, which is of course far below anything you could possibly resolve. Okay, so we do this calculation. We use a model of the string network, which is just captures the two-point correlations by taking independent string segments and sort of moving them around in the right way to match cosmic string simulations. And here's what we get. Here's the power spectrum for cosmic strings. This is at a redshift of 30, blue and green, solid and long dashed. The short dashed ones are for redshift of 200. And this this one is the inflationary contribution, and this is a cosmic string contribution, which actually what we're doing is we're putting in the WMAP constraint. So if the cosmic strings are there, 10% of the inflationary contribution, then on short scales, they would actually start reaching up to the inflationary contributions. So if you...
inflationary contributions are those scales, right? You can just extrapolate.
Well, I mean, we do have, I mean, the, you know, inflation, the power spectrum is produced as scale free. So if we assume that that's true down to up to those scales, then yeah. And okay, you can adjust for running of the spectral index. So there's other kinds of parameters you can try to probe with these models. That's true. The question is just basically this assumes a scale free spectrum for the standard inflationary models. You add in more parameters, these constraints will become slightly less. This will become slightly less constraining. However, there are so many modes here that by adding just one parameter, for example, a running of the index, will be very easy to fit that. I don't think it will degrade these results at all. So,
all cosmic strings in this calculation?
By independent string segments that are moving around so as to reproduce the two-point correlations of strings we see in string simulation. So the so-called actually, the people who first talked about this were Hindmarsh and Vincent. It's the same model that was used in the Albrecht and Robinson-Batty papers. Okay, so this is a treasure trove of information. If you look at the kinds of constraints you can get, actually, let me see, I might have a slightly better picture of this. Here we go, yeah, just a second. Here we go. So. This is the same plot I showed you before, just a nicer version. Here's the 10% limit, which comes from WMAP. And there's a similar limit from pulsars, looking at the timing of pulsars and the shifts that will be introduced by gravitational waves produced by cosmic strings. That gives you an upper limit. And LOFAR itself will not be able to improve on WMAP, but if we could build a 100-kilometer or 1,000-kilometer-sized 20 radio telescope, you could actually start pushing deep into the range of allowed of the allowed parameter space. In particular, in these inflation models that produce strings at the end, you still have to produce enough perturbations in the inflation model to explain the WMAP observations. And so, if you're assuming that sort of a model, you can actually cover the entire parameter space. So if you build a 1,000-kilometer-squared radio telescope that can measure these 21 centimeter observations, this 21 centimeter absorption spectrum, you will either find cosmic strings or not. Okay, you can either rule out this whole brain inflation scenario that produces cosmic strings at the end, or you will detect cosmic strings. In terms of the cosmic variance limit, you can get, this is the G mu parameter here. The current limits are 10 to the minus 7. With such an instrument, you can get down to about 10 to the minus 12. The amount of information available is at the limit of roughly 10 to the minus 15. This is the 10%, using the cleanest 10% of the sky. All right. And this converts, if you ask what's the kind of mass scale that this converts to with this kind of an instrument here, that's 10 to the 13 GeV. What you could probe down to. So this all sounds like pie in the sky, but there are actually funded studies for doing science from building a radio interferometer. I told you you'd really want to go outside of the Earth because the atmosphere shields you from these long wavelength radio observations. There are craters on the moon, which are 100 kilometers on the side. So the entire far side of the moon is about just 1,500 or so kilometers in diameter. So if you, and as I said, the technology is really old school. So you could populate a large crater on the far side of the moon with basically tape that is that contains conductors and use those as to build a radio interferometer. And this is one concept study, and we're involved in a similar one. So here's a artist's drawing of this kind of an idea. And here's a slightly sillier artist's drawing that graphic artists who collaborates with me made. And the idea is basically that it does sound really far out, but NASA actually has the first list on, it has a list of 101 things to do from the moon. And the first thing on the list is a radio array to do astronomical observations. So this, I think, is the closest thing we have to a scientific rationale for actually exploring the far side of the moon. I don't know. Why would I tell you? I don't remember. Okay, so that's it. Let me just end on that picture. Okay.
Okay, should I start? You could probably do the same thing with the axis surveys, I assume, or the 20-watt centimeter surveys after ionization. Because you can make the power spectrum smaller with the scales. Do you have any idea if they could be comparable in any way?
What Niyash is mentioning is the fact that you do get cold gas in galaxies. And so they absorb 21. Actually, warm gas will emit 21 centimeter radiation. And so you can probe the galaxy distribution using that effect. The problem is that there are really basically no galaxies before Richard 10. So it's wonderful, you can map out the galaxy distribution of basically the observable universe. But in terms of getting to the information content, you would get going out to these very large redshifts, it's not competitive. Also, the scale below which the perturbations become nonlinear also has grown by the time. So that's going to be harder.
So say a little bit more about the wakes and how you're going to do the calculation of the 21 centimeters.
Well, the idea is to do this for a single wake and then extrapolate and see, you know, how much of an effect you would see and how much sensitivity you would need to actually see the emission. Basically, the idea is looking at a piece of string. Two cases: one is you have a straight string going fast, and looking at the shock produced in the gas behind it. Looking at the temperature change and then converting it into a brightness temperature that would be seen in the emission here, and basically. At early times, so at redshifts of about 200 or so, so this is the CMB temperature dropping with time. This is redshift going this way, dropping with time. And here's the gas temperature doing this. And right around here, the spin temperature is still coupled to the gas temperature. But if the gas temperature was raised, the spin temperature would be raised with it. And so you'd see a blip. As soon as the spin temperature rises above the CMB temperature, you see a net emission of 21 centimeter photons, and so you would see glow. Whereas in most of the universe where you don't have this effect, you would see, you would see the absorption. And so as long as you're able to raise locally the temperature of the gas above the CMB temperature, you see you see an emission. And this effect here translates into 40 millikelvin or so, 50 millikelvin. So as long as you can get a larger, and here the redshift of 100, the temperature in the CMB is roughly 300 kelvin. And so as long as you can, as the cosmic string raises the gas temperature above room temperature, you should see an emission signal. I did that wrong. This is supposed to be all absorption. Okay, so you would see a positive blip. And then correlated patches along the sky. You're going much too long. So this is just a single line of sight. So you would look at lots of lines of sight. Actually, all of these experiments would basically look at an entire patch of the sky, and do this along all line of sights. And so then you would try to connect up pieces of emission that stick out among the sort of general background of 10, 20 millikelvin. This is a 10 millikelvin.
So how big is the wake?
But we haven't actually done that calculation, so we're still looking at. But first calculations actually indicate that you get a rise in temperature of tens of kelvin. So it sounds like it could be very, very visible. But
terrestrial foregrounds, like some radio or something, spiking up at one frequency, that'd be a contaminant.
So TV. For example, so at 100 megahertz, you have TV stations. That's absolutely right. They're actually not that much of a problem because TV stations are analog. TV is narrowband, and so you could just not look at those ranges in frequency. But since everyone is now converting to digital TV, that actually becomes broadband, and so it's harder to avoid. But of course, if you went into the far side of the moon, you wouldn't have that sort of. That's one of the reasons. I mean, this is not just for this. Actually, it's not just for this because at some level, the low frequency radio sky is bright. Basically, it's very difficult to do high sensitivity radio observations because with cell phones and BlackBerries and the rest of it.
I'm not going to have BlackBerries, are they?
Right. This is kind of supposed to indicate if you overpopulate the moon and do all the science from it, then at some point you're going to have to start worrying about local radio foregrounds. But
your signals on the moon, is each of these antennas
right? They would all have to be correlated. Right. So, you don't need much bandwidth, right? I mean, we're talking about tens of megahertz. Current radio receivers have bandwidths of gigahertz. So it's not, as I said, this is really low tech actually, but you are onto something. Correlating two receivers is not going to be a problem. Correlating, millions of receivers, will be a computational problem or a electronics problem, and it will need power. So you will need to have. This is the same sort of problems that SKA has to address. Except again, this is much lower tech than SKA in the sense of much longer wavelengths.
Okay, so
think about the cost of this, it's a fraction of the US budget bailout this year. People are pretty excited about superstring theory, and if people decided that this is something really, really important, and if actually everyone worldwide decided that they should chip in and generate 10 to the 12 dollars.
So one very last question. If not, let's thank the panel here.
What's exciting about this is that the answer could have been that. The answer could have been that you have to go to Jupiter orbits.
But if it's lower energy inflation, then it could be lower. I've got a gut energy strain, but just lower energy. Yeah, but the energy scale is
so it could be just lighting.
Then you would see it.